Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse, great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices, changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. Our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson will join us throughout the show, of course, and first edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly. But first up, Sam Kerr. Racism, culture wars, or just poor judgment? As close listeners to the podcast will be well aware, we recorded both our main show and Stoppage Time last week before the news of the charge of racially aggravated harassment dropped into news feeds around the world and has been insatiably dissected ever since. The upside to the fact that we've had a week to digest this is that we've been able to listen to, read, and watch all of the points of view as they've flurried about, many of which have shifted. So we'll go into our most obvious source to try and unpick what's happened so far and where it might go from here. Formerly of the ABC and now host of a recently launched podcast, which we'll hear all about as well, the sports ambassador herself, and the name of her podcast as well, of course, Tracy Holmes. Then on to the field, 2 points separate the Premier League's top three as the battle between Arsenal, Liverpool and, of course, Manchester City shapes to rival some of the iconic title races. Jonathan Wilson from The Guardian will join us to look at the season so far and ahead to how the final 10 weeks might play out. Now, Edge, we've had some stories break in the hours after the show drops over the last 9 years, but from a domestic point of view, this one is definitely on the podium.
It certainly is, because it's a serious thing. And you know, and also the knock-on effect of the dominoes into all sorts of different aspects of football and social culture and racism discussions are obvious to all. And we're going to unpack as much as we can with Tracy in the time we have. Well, I'll look forward to that. But while Sam Kerr's been dominating the headlines, what about our young Matildas who stormed into the semi-finals of the under-20 AFC Asian Cup for women, Rob? Mm. The young Matildas, they played in the snow, the cold weather, the rain, the sleet, the hail, and they've got 3 wins in a row and they've qualified.
Hang on, isn't this your lead story for the end of the show, World Cup Corner? Don't leave your best work on the cutting room floor, mate.
No. World Cup Corner is, I'm talking about the Olympics. I'm not talking about the under-20s.
Oh, wow. This is women's football from start to finish on this show. And
well, it is. It's important. I just want a big shout out to Leah Blaney, the coach, and Jessica Nash, the captain, who plays for Melbourne Victory in the A-League women's competition. This is a great achievement. 3 wins in a row, qualify for the semi-finals. They play Japan shortly in the next couple of days in the semi-final, which will be a big event for them. But they've qualified for the under-20 FIFA Women's World Cup. They're going to Colombia in September this year, and they're going to do Australia proud, Rob.
Excellent. And I'll tell you who did box-to-box proud today at the futsal indoor tournament in close to 40 degrees temperature was the great Derek Dyson here. Before we welcome Willem, breaking news, I was trying to ask you before we logged on, Derek, how it all went. Give us the headlines, mate.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, I played in what's called the Claudia Cup, which is an annual tournament that sees the best of Eastern Suburban futsal players taking on each other at Mount Evelyn Pro Futsal Arena. I was in the Healesville team this year and we did pretty well. Won a few, lost a few. I think we ended up about 5th out of 8 teams, which wasn't too bad in the sweltering heat. It was the Lilydale Lemons who I think put pay to the side from Croydon in the final and took the silverware. But look, I'm just glad that I came through it in one piece. And yeah, I've lost about 2 stone just in sweat in the last 24 hours.
Well, Willem, if you had played in a similar tournament in the climbs that you're in, somehow I think you might have put on weight, given it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, I'm just back from Alkmaar, Rob, where I saw Matt Ryan not touch the ball for 90 minutes as AZ Alkmaar beat Excelsior 4-0, and they've built that nice 20,000 seat stadium right on the side of a freeway with no tree coverage. It was grey, freezing cold, brutal wind, so the complete opposite. And yeah, I'm looking at Derek sweating there at the Healesville Sanctuary. And as I said before we came on, I would happily swap with you, Derek. I'm desperate for a bit of heat, so we'll well, we won't be able to arrange it, but you take my point. We jump into first edition news, Rob, and I know you've got a long chat coming up with Tracy on this very matter, but the facts, if you have missed them, are that Sam Kerr will face a Wimbledon Magistrates Court in February 2025, charged with racially aggravated harassment of a London police officer in January 23. Kerr will reportedly deny she called the officer a white bastard on a night out in Twickenham. The incident and charge caught both Football Australia and Tony Gustafsson unaware broke. This has edge opened up all manner of debate on racism and larrikinism. Craig Foster has found himself at the middle in the middle of it. He's walked back his initial sort of line of racism is racism, and now states racism can only be perpetrated against a marginalised person or group. As I say, the Aussie larrikinism has sort of run through it throughout the week. What she actually called the officer is one thing, and whether that warrants a four-day criminal charge is another. But I think keeping in the dark is probably the more or the most significant aspect. I mean, that could have broken right in the middle of the World Cup for all Sam knew.
It's been amazing in the response, hasn't it? I mean, a lot of commentators feel like they've got to talk about things. So they were out of the blocks quickly and expressing opinions and views on this when, you know, to be honest, there's only probably 5 or 10% of the information in the public domain. There'll be a lot that we don't know. Quoting Donald Rumsford, there's known unknowns and unknown unknowns. So there's a lot that will come out through this process, whether it goes to court or not. But a lot of people got out of the box and expressed opinions when, you know, they probably would have been better advised to sit back and just see what information, you know, came to light. And we've seen Craig Foster initially criticise Sam Kerr and then obviously apologise for that criticism. And who knows, he might flip his opinion one more time when more information comes out. But you're right, some things stand out. The relationship between Sam Kerr and Football Australia is obviously a point of contention, because why did she decide not to inform them of this incident and process? We'll talk to Tracy about that, I'm sure. That's the obvious one, that everybody's asking a question inside the game. It'll be really interesting to see what Football Australia decides to do and when they decide to do it, if they decide to do anything.
Western Sydney Wanderers CEO Scott Hudson has met with senior representatives of venues New South Wales and New South Wales Police following Saturday week's Sydney Derby. Three bans have been suspended by venues New South Wales, while a further two will be subject to review, with ongoing consultation also committed to. Now, Rob Hudson had earlier supported club fans unequivocally following the policing issues of 2 weekends back and stated, rest assured, we will continue to stand in solidarity with our members and fans on this issue. One of the strongest statements, I think, seen by A-League administrators in some time, but Nick Garcia's statement on behalf of the APL then left a few people a bit cold, I think. There was still a fair undercurrent of behave yourselves when he finally came out following Hudson and the Wanderers taking a dance, Rob.
Yeah, look, it's interesting, isn't it? You'd hope that under these sorts of circumstances that both the organising body of the competition and the clubs themselves, I'm not saying they always have to be on the same page. I mean, if they are too far on the same page, then, you know, we would accuse them of drinking each other's Kool-Aid. But in a case as challenging as this one and as likely to blow up at any moment, you feel that they might have had a conversation with each other before putting out somewhat contradictory press releases.
Onto the pitch in the A-League Women's, Western United's six-game winning run has been ended by Sydney FC, their lead atop the table cut to just a point with three to play. Courtney Vine, who we've discussed a little bit over the past couple of weeks, was back and best afield in the 3-1 result, scoring twice and setting up another. That leaves things pretty tight at the top, just 4 points separating the top five, Victory, Central Coast and City also in the mix. And in the men's competition, the Mariners have gone top of the table with a 3-0 win over MacArthur. Josh Nisbet, another goal and an assist. He's the form player of the competition at the moment after Wellington dropped all 3 points to Melbourne City. The Mariners host Wellington on April 6th. Now, Edge, we unfortunately missed this one last week, but Mariners CEO Sean Muehlkamp is going to step down from his role at the end of the season after 9 years. Just a quick word on him, if possible. I think one of the great administrative innings, really, most of it while under siege, and then coming through that to leave with what's some pretty unforeseeable for a lot of that being some silverware and stability, more importantly.
Well, he's done a great job, hasn't he? Regardless of the decision as to why he's decided to leave at this point, but 9 years. And I think the greatest tribute was the active fans have decided to call their terrace or the hill where they stand and enjoy supporting the Central Coast Mariners. They've decided that to name that area after Sean, which I think was a great tribute to their respect for him and the hard yards that he'd done when the Central Coast had been, probably the least one of the least resourced clubs in the league, and they'd also had periods of success at different times. So, well done to Sean. It'll be interesting to see where that club goes from now. I mean, Richard Peel, the executive chairman and part owner, is taking on the role of executive chair now, and he's going to stand into the role for a little bit. Well, just wonder whether he will do it for a long time. I know Richard a little bit. He probably likes to do it. So, yeah, he might be there for a while before they get a replacement.
To Europe, we'll leave the Premier League for now because we do have Jonathan Wilson coming up shortly. So we'll start in Germany, where Harry Kane has become the first player to score 4 hat-tricks in a debut Bundesliga season among 5 separate goal scorers as Bayern beat Mainz 8-0. Kane's tally has shot to 30 goals in 25 league games, while he also laid on an assist. Bayern also overturned a first leg deficit to progress past Napoli in the Champions League midweek. But Derek, despite all of that, they remain 10 points shy of Bayer Leverkusen, who were 2-0 winners over Wolfsburg. It's been a very frustrating period of note by their standards, and I think Bayern took out a little bit of that anger against lonely Mainz, who were in the relegation zone. No mercy at 8-0.
Absolutely not. And yeah, Bayern are a wounded animal at the moment. They're still a fantastic team, and you know, the quality in Bundesliga doesn't maybe go all the way down to Mainz. But as you said, Leverkusen just keep winning games and winning them relatively comfortably as well. So, look, there's no reason at this stage to think that they won't win Bundesliga. They'd have to really slip up quite badly to let Bayern through and pass them. You never say never, of course. Neverkusen, of course, is what they are called because they have not won Bundesliga, but they will never have a better opportunity. And they seem relatively calm and they're crunching these results out week on week. A few more weekends like this and I think they'll probably think they're nearly there.
Yeah, what a way to break the drought. If they do manage to do it, they might have a couple of weeks to celebrate while still playing a bit of football on the pitch. Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army. Now is the time to lock in your place at the Paris Olympics and cheer on the Matildas in the European Summer Sun. That tour is live and on sale. Ed, you and the crew are going to be there, hungry for a medal, some French cheese and wine and pastry, no doubt. So where do they need to head?
I need to go on a diet before I go to France because I'm known for inhaling a baguette or two at lunchtime. They are so good over there. The bread taste in France, as you can testify with them, the bread in France is pretty good. No, it's going to be great. The draw is on the 20th of March, so we don't actually know the cities of which the Matildas will play, but you can go to the website at ggatravel.com.au or ggarmy.com and get all the details, ticket guarantees, whole range of information, and we can't wait to get a good crew, a great group of Matildas fans together and support the Tillies in the Olympic Games. They'll be hunting a medal, won't they, Rob?
Absolutely. I know we've talked about this for a while now, and I mean, one of the saddest parts of the whole Sam Kerr story is that regardless of how her situation plays out, is that she's not going to get to be a part of the campaign. And wouldn't it be like adding insult to injury if they do go on to win that medal that we've all been craving for so long, and in the prime of her career, Sam doesn't get the chance to put the whichever colour medal is around her neck. So it's going to be massive. The Olympics themselves are going to be huge. France, particularly off Tokyo, the COVID games. I'll be watching it from here, but I cannot wait.
Socceroos and Matilda Central does come this week with Steve Maxwell in mind, Socceroos cap 339. He played 4 times over 6 years and he has sadly passed at just 59. He's a member of Football South Australia's Hall of Fame and a Player Life member. Edgy played with Adelaide City, where he won the NSL title 3 times and the Cup twice, and he was at Marconi 2. He scored 82 goals. What sort of player was he for those who didn't see him play, and what are your defining memories of Steve?
He was a very good player, and I've got good memories of him. And taken too young, wasn't he, Willem? I mean, that just caught me a bit by surprise, the news of that today. So, no, he was a very, very handy player, represented his club very well, and a bit of an icon for South Australian football.
Mary Fowler started and scored for Man City just 6 minutes into their meeting with Tottenham in the FA Cup quarterfinals. And she also buried her spot kick as she did against France in the shootout at the World Cup last year, but to no avail as Spurs went through. Better news for Courtney Nevin. She played the first half for Leicester as they had a win over Liverpool. So they are into the last four of the FA Cup. And a follow-up on last week's chat with Kit Holden. Her St. Pauli had a little bit of a wobble, but Rob, they did have a win. Jackson Irvine and Connor Metcalf both starting as they got a 2-0 win over Hertha Berlin. So they retain their 5-point lead as they search for promotion to the German top flight.
Thank you, Willem. Now, I've got my little addition postscript to Socceroos and Matilda Central. Now, I know this is a football program, but I'm going to introduce a little golf into this, so bear with me. So I've been learning the game, improving gradually. So I've gone off to play nine holes at Brighton Public Golf Course after a lesson I had recently, and a couple of guys playing ahead of me call me through. I noticed a Scottish accent on one of them and get chatting to him. They asked me to join their group, and I'm playing a few holes with him. Lo and behold, it's a Socceroo from Scotland, of course. Kenny Murphy, the sprightly 67-year-old, played 15 games for Australia. He was born in Dundee, and he was just the loveliest bloke. He came to Australia for football, and he was so humble. I had to sort of almost prize out the information from him as we were wandering around the course playing. So to you, Kenny, top bloke, mate. Thanks for inviting me to join your group, and hopefully I'll get to see you out there one day again in the not too far distant future. All right, guys, I'm going to wrap it up there. We're talking to Tracy Holmes after the break. It's going to be a deep dive, a longer conversation. That's next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, we said off the top of the show that over the last nearly decade, we've had a few stories drop after we've recorded the podcast, but not many as big as the Sam Kerr bombshell. The advantage, of course, is that we've had the last week to listen, to watch, to read, and develop our own sense, because I question whether anybody was able to immediately define the way that they felt the moment that they first heard it. Is it racism? Is it culture wars? Is it poor judgment? We're talking about Sam Kerr, of course, here, and our guest to discuss it all, to try to pick it apart and work out where to from here is from the Sports Ambassador podcast, formerly of the ABC, our good friend Tracy Holmes. How are you, Tracy?
Oh, I'm good, Rob. How are you? Big week.
Oh, it's been massive, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, look, before we get started, look, it's important to point out that Samantha Kerr, while she's been charged with racially aggravated harassment, her lawyers will argue an abusive process at a pretrial hearing on April 26 and will seek to have the charge downgraded or dropped, according to court documents cited by multiple UK media outlets. So in the absence of a finding, as we record this podcast, the whole charge may well be moot if it's thrown out, or we may be in a long wait for a trial. The outcome of that attempt will inform some of the decisions by Football Australia, but we'll get to that. So, Tracy, you know, there is a lot to this story, as we've already indicated. The nature of the charge itself, are the words racist? In fact, can they be racist? And also the question around whether Sam not informing Football Australia, which may well prove to be as big a problem as any for her, depending on the way it all plays out. So to get started, I've been really enjoying the Sports Ambassador podcast. We'll talk to our listeners about how they can get involved and listen. But one of the most informative discussions that I've heard in the past week is the one that you had with the former Director of Public Prosecutions for the UK, Sir Max Hill, KC, on how the charge of racially aggravated harassment actually came about. Can you talk to us about that? And obviously our listeners can listen to him in detail via your podcast, but give us a précis of that, Tracy.
Sure. So I think it's really important to point out that he only stepped down as the DPP in November of 2023. And this incident, of course, happened in January of 2023. So we need to keep that in context. And because of that, he couldn't actually speak about specific cases or the Sam Kerr case as we all understand. But he was able to talk about the law itself, the law that she's been charged with, and maybe potentially explain why it would have taken so long. So if I summarise what he said on that, the law, as you mentioned at the start, it was racially aggravated harassment, which is a more serious charge than just harassment. But in order for that, or to for somebody to be charged with that, there is quite a stringent process that has to be gone through. And it's a two-step process from the Crown Prosecutor's Office. The police have to go away, do, you know, all of their investigating, come up with all of the evidence that they think they can present in a case like this. That would include things like body cam from the police officers themselves, potentially dash cam from the taxi, you know, cameras from the street, witnesses from anybody else that saw it or heard what happened. Obviously, Sam herself, if she had people with her, they would provide witness statements as well. So they're given time to go and get as much as they can. In the process, they can sometimes, you know, correspond with the Crown Prosecutor's Office to say, does it look like we have enough, whatever. When it's all presented to the Crown Prosecutor's Office, they look at it and it's two stages. So the first stage is, do they have enough evidence to be able to, you know, likely prove this particular case in a court of law? Because otherwise it's just wasting the court's time if you present something and you're not going to have anywhere near enough evidence. Once it's passed that hurdle, then it goes to the next stage, and the next stage is a consideration of public interest, the depth of the evidence, and again, basically much more of a fine-tooth comb of what the charge relates to and whether there is enough evidence to go ahead and firstly charge the person and then go ahead with the trial. So what we're seeing now is that Sam's legal team are going to try in April to have the charge thrown out or potentially reduced, so it's not that enhanced aggravated racial charge, because that would be a difference between potentially 6 months in jail, maybe 2 years. And it could be thrown out if, you know, they can prove that there's been an abusive process here. But I also looked up the law in the UK for abusive process, and you really have to prove that, you know, there was a gross miscarriage of the process. And what's been interesting in this is if you go back and look at, most people wouldn't do this, but I went back and had a look at the annual report of the DPP or the Crown Prosecutor's Office for 2022-2023. And in that calendar year, they had 400,000 prosecutions. I mean, this is a system that is entirely overloaded. So we know that there's lots of really extreme and quite violent crime happening. So, you know, it would cascade downwards as to when something is going to be looked at or reviewed or prosecuted or a charge finally put out. And so I guess that, to my mind, gave some sort of indication as to why this might have taken so long already and why it might still take up to another year if the trial actually goes ahead.
So the very fact that that Sam has the appeal scheduled for 4 weeks away is reasonable, and if it goes her way, then that's, by the sounds of it, the best case scenario that she could have hoped for.
Yeah, that at this stage, that is the best case scenario, which is obviously why her legal team is opting for that.
Okay, so before I hand over to Edge, I've got one that I'm going to ask you and our listeners for a little indulgence on, because I think to set the scene on this next proposition is incredibly delicate. And the person that I want to quote here is one which has been in the middle of discussions like this for many years, is directly connected to football. And I speak of none other than Craig Foster. And he to me represents some of the thinking that I feel that a lot of people have managed or needed to go through over the course of the past week. So I'll quote Craig here, as we're well aware, outspoken advocate against racism, and you know, to remind people, he was awarded the Member of the Order of Australia in 2021 for his work on multiculturalism, human rights, and refugee advocacy. So I don't think that there's anyone who's in a better position to comment here. Now, his original position was that if the charge is proven, Sam should be sacked as captain of Matildas. But in the past 24 hours, he's now apologised to Sam on X, saying, like many, I mistakenly thought that comments that referenced any colour and were discriminatory, demeaning, or hostile were a form of racism. I apologise to Sam for that mistake. He then goes on to elaborate in detail, references an opinion piece in The Guardian by Alana Linton, professor of cultural and social analysis at Western Sydney University and former Socceroo Francis Owatifi, who is a lawyer himself and chair of the Professional Footballers of Australia, to inform his change of heart. Now, to the question, Tracy, point blank, are the words being widely reported racist? And in fact, from a purely philosophical point of view, can they be racist?
So this is where it gets incredibly complex and quite difficult to explain. Difficult on one level and pretty simple on another, okay? So I think the case itself needs to be sort of partitioned into specific areas. The first one is the legal case itself, which we know very little about. All we know is the charge, the little bits of information that have been dripped out about her, Sam Kerr, that is, vomiting in the back of a taxi, some sort of a dispute happening after that, and then the police there. And I've even read a report, one report where it said the driver actually diverted and went to the police station, which is where this kind of then unfolded in its entirety. So the legal case we know very little about because we haven't seen any of the body of evidence. And the only thing we have got to rely on is the little bits of info that have been drip fed to specific media. So that's one thing. Can't comment on that because we don't know what's going to happen and what we're going to find out. The next thing is, should Sam Kerr have informed Football Australia, which as the captain of the nation, you would think was probably the right thing to do, given that she knew of the charge at least 6 weeks ago, but she knew about the incident more than a year ago, and that was heading into the World Cup. Imagine what would have happened if all of this kind of blew up during the World Cup. I mean, it would have been horrendous on so many levels for everybody, including for Sam. And then there's this third thing, you know, and that is, what is racism? What is racist? Can you conflate the two? And there are different people in different camps that will argue so many different strands to that story. Essentially, the law that she's been charged under is this aggravated racial harassment. That doesn't define that you have to be from what we would consider a marginalised or minority group. It doesn't mention any particular colour. So, in fact, if you just use anybody's racial profile in an harassing way, then you are guilty or you have fallen into this sort of territory that they will try to prosecute. Racism, we know, is something that is kind of more systemic, institutionalised. It's marginalised groups, it's minorities. Traditionally, it's all the power has been, we've seen it to be with white colonial mindsets and working against and disenfranchising people who are not white. So you've got that as racism. But the other thing that I think is important to reference here, and it is something that Sir Max Hill KC mentioned, and that is that, you know, laws are constantly reviewed because societies change. And we're also seeing a process in society now where there are some black people who are incredibly privileged and there's a lot of white people who are really struggling. And, you know, you only have to look to America, and this is a much bigger discussion, but a lot of people are talking about democracy is failing. And one of the reasons democracy is failing and that people like Donald Trump get elected as president of the US is because there's a lot of people who feel like they're being sidelined and left out by the mere fact that they are white. In America, a lot of them are referred to as white trash. It's pretty horrendous when you start having people of any colour, any background, any race, any nationality, any minority group being targeted and vilified in such a way. And so this is where all of these things, you know, overlap. There are people that very definitely say there is no way a white cop could, you know, feel harassed or threatened by a person like Sam Kerr, who is, you know, of Indian heritage. She comes from what has been a marginalised LGBTQI community. So there's all of those arguments as well. But if you really want to talk about power imbalance, that's shifting. And, of course, I guess many people would say, you know, we don't know anything about the police officer in this story. I guarantee he's not earning millions of dollars a year. You know, can probably make a safe bet he doesn't live in Richmond. He might. I don't know who he's married to. I don't know if he's in a same-sex marriage. I don't know if he's married to a black person or a Chinese person. I don't know if he coaches a minority children's team on weekends. We know absolutely nothing. So we can't judge that way or the other by saying he's more privileged than anybody else in this scenario. And these are the sorts of arguments, no doubt, that will play out in both the case that, you know, Sam's lawyers will take to the court in April, or whether it goes to the full hearing next year.
We also don't know a lot of things. We don't know the state of the cab. You know, we've heard reports that Sam vomited in the back of the cab. I mean, never been a cab driver, but I imagine they get pretty upset when that happens. We also don't know the extent of the vehement nature of the way the words were said too. And something that's been
Or they might not have. And, you know, some people have said, you know, did the cop provoke her? All of that, yeah, you know. Yeah. And that's right. We don't know any side. Yeah. Yeah.
And so one question I have is, in the legal process, do you think the body cam footage will become public at any stage? Is that something that might come down the line and be in one way, you know, even a bigger story or not? Yeah.
Well, that's it. We can't tell. We don't know. But if I go on what Sir Max was saying, the former director of public prosecutions in London, and, you know, looking at the sort of the benchmark that has to be passed as far as evidence and what sort of evidence there is to enable a charge to be upgraded to the more serious charge of not just harassment, but of aggravated racial harassment, it would seem to me they'd be pretty stupid if they're trying to argue that without sufficient evidence.
Yeah, I guess that's the part of the story that will unfold. What about Football Australia's situation? We saw a remarkable situation where both the head coach, Tony Gustafsson, and the CEO, James Johnson, who had very significant scheduled media appointments to announce the matches against China of the Matildas. So on the morning, this story breaks, and they just basically admitted that they had no idea that this was happening and that they were caught on the hop, so to speak. So it creates a lot of questions about Sam's relationship with Football Australia and why she decided not to inform Football Australia. What's been your impression of how Football Australia's navigating this tricky situation?
Yeah, it is tricky, and they're in a very difficult situation because we know how much Australian fans adore Sam, not just Australian fans, but football fans around the world. She is the captain of the national team. The Matildas have done so much to kind of galvanise all of that emotion and support through the FIFA World Cup, but for many years leading up to that. So, you know, she's held in very high regard. Suddenly, I mean, I always try and put myself in the shoes of all of the different components, right? And so if you wake up as the CEO or the chairman or any of the board members or anybody that works at Football Australia on the morning that you're preparing to give a press conference to talk about the continued success of the Matildas, and here's the next big thing, we're going to be playing China in two matches leading into the Olympic Games, and you've got these headlines from around the world, it is a shock. And it did shock everybody. I don't think there would have been a single person not shocked by that, because it just seemed to be, you know, completely out of the blue and at odds with the aura around Sam Kerr and the Matildas team. So what could they do? They could call off the press conference. That would have raised a whole lot of questions and not look good. They fronted up, and I give them credit for that. you know, we're the hardest markers in that department in the media. If people don't front up, that's when you go, oh, hang on, what have they got to hide here? They fronted up. There was very little they could say because they didn't know the extent of the charges or the nature of what happened. They still hadn't spoken to Sam at that point, other than, I think, a very brief bit of correspondence between James Johnson and Sam to make sure she was okay, so checking on her welfare. And then I think it took well into the second day before they were even able to have a chat. So clearly there is something wrong with the relationship. I don't know what or to what extent. I don't know if it was just, you know, a minor thing and they decided not to tell Football Australia because Chelsea is her day-to-day employer. But the fact is, everybody refers to her as the national captain. She is employed. She's paid by Football Australia when she represents the country. And she's out injured at the moment, which is another complicating factor to this story. But I don't know. It would have been very difficult for Football Australia to navigate. But at times like this, and I think this is where it's really difficult, and I understand where supporters or non-supporters even get very emotionally wound up by these sorts of stories, but that's not an option. It's not something that a sports governing body has the privilege of. They can't be emotional in any decision that they take because there's so much riding on this. You know, the reputation of the Matildas, the reputation of Sam Kerr, the reputation of all of their sponsors flow on to other sports, other teams like the Socceroos and what have you. So they have to take a pretty clinical approach. And of course, I think they were about as emotional as you can be in saying, share concern for her well-being, and that's the first thing we wanted to check. That's excellent because that's what they should be doing if they're a responsible organisation. But then they go back to what their policies and what their structures say. And, you know, earlier we were talking about the differences between racism and racially, you know, aggravated harassment. And we need to keep that in mind. But when you've got a team that has done so much to talk about, you know, zero tolerance to racism, and we can argue as long as you like whether this was racism or not, and a lot of people would say it wasn't, but zero tolerance to racism, being all-inclusive, being a welcoming and diverse team, all of those messages do come under scrutiny when you've got a situation like this playing out. Now, best case scenario, Sam Kerr goes to the courts in April and the case is dismissed or the charges dropped or you know, whatever unfolds there. That would be the best case scenario for everybody, but that might not happen. And in the meantime, every time one of the Matildas players fronts up in a mix zone or a press conference or to talk to the media, they're going to be asked about this. It's kind of the thing that hangs over everybody. And this is where governing bodies need to be very strong in their commitment, understanding that it's not just Sam Kerr they have to care about. They've got to care about the welfare of the rest of the team as well that is going to the Olympics, that would love to be able to just focus on this 100% and come home with a gold medal. Wouldn't that be great? And so it's to give everybody clear air where they could actually exercise one of, their points in their ethics and behavioural standards.
Well, it appears that Sam Kerr and Football Australia and Chelsea have some important decisions to make in the coming weeks and months. I mean, what you've raised there is a very good segue to my next question, because one of the ways that Sam could potentially take heat out of this is to stand down as the captain of the Matildas for a short while all this is sorted out, to allow the team to focus on the Olympics without having this constant distraction. Do you think that's a realistic possibility or something that might be considered?
Look, I don't know, and I don't know who's advising Sam. And, you know, what their strategy might be. Her legal team might say, no, that's not a good strategy. We're not we're not, why should we stand down or, you know, take a lesser position because we don't think she's guilty of anything. So it very much depends on the people around her. And again, we don't know, you know, what sort of discussions they're having. But I can't help thinking through this. And these are sort of lessons that become 101 for athletes, for governing bodies afterwards, when they look back at cases like this and how the whole thing unfolded. And I can't help thinking, like, on the night in question, you know, perhaps it was one of those situations. And everybody, of course, is incredibly embarrassed by this. But if you front up and you say, look, last night I was out celebrating, probably celebrated a little bit too much, probably drank a little bit too much. This is what happened. I'm incredibly sorry about that. I think pretty much everyone would understand that and support that. But when you start talking about the captain of a national team, you know, I think that does bring elevated levels of responsibility, which do sit on Sam Kerr's shoulders and any Australian captain. I know people have asked the question this week, whether it was another team, whether it was a male who had this situation, would they still have the captaincy of the national team? And I think many people say probably not. So you have to look at sort of the whole double standards conversation as well. I mean, there's a lot. There's just so much to this. And I think, you know, the other thing that people need to consider is that in all of this, when there's no information, people start making things up.
Or, they do, don't they?
You know, they just fill in the blanks, don't they? And again, it's another lesson in why transparency and honesty is always the best policy, and to kind of get out first.
Well, there's a long way to go in this story, Rob. I'll hand back to you. A fascinating discussion with Tracy. Thank you very much. And we'll obviously be watching with great interest as to what transpires and unfolds.
Yeah, I guess I just have one brief one before we say goodbye, Tracy, and that is, you know, can Football Australia afford to kick this one down the road too far? Does a decision need to be made one way or the other? Do they wait for the appeal process, the outcome before or after? How much time do you think they've got before they have to make a decision? And is that the trigger point for when they ultimately have no time left up their sleeve?
Well, I think it's really interesting to just look at how it unfolded and compare it to what happened on the field in a rugby league game in Las Vegas between two black players. And there was an allegation of a racial slur. It was immediately referred to the judiciary. The player in question admitted he'd done what he'd done and apologised. The whole thing was dealt with very quickly. That sting in that story is now gone. And so I think, you know, for as far as Football Australia is concerned, I think they missed that opportunity. And it's one of those things where it didn't matter what option they took, they'd be scrutinised and there'd be a group of people not happy with it. But that is the nature of being a strong governing body and, you know, trying to look after all of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. But I think by not acting and saying, well, we'll wait and see, it just extends the conversation, the sting in the tail, the pressure that is on all of the other Matildas players now every time they front up until this thing is decided one way or another.
Yeah, it goes on, doesn't it, Tracy? It's a fascinating conversation. We could talk for another hour and still not be anywhere near the bottom of it, but we really appreciate you distilling some of the conversations that you've already had with experts around the world, your own thoughts and expertise on the subject. And we, I think, you know, just listening to what's been said in this conversation so far, that it's a little snapshot of a time capsule even of what has happened so far. And insofar as we can speculate, a look at what might happen in the short to immediate term. Now, Tracy, before we let you go, the Sports Ambassador, I've been really enjoying it. Tell us a little bit about the podcast, the platform, I should say, more broadly, how our listeners can get involved and where you're planning to take it.
Oh, thanks for that, Rob. Look, it is for subscribers only, the Sports Ambassador podcast, that is. And they can do that by going to looking up a Patreon page for the Sports Ambassador. But I do put stuff up there that is for non-paying subscribers as well. So I put little elements or snapshots of some of the interviews I've had that are freely accessible, some of my writings and musings. But the one-hour podcast, which is very similar to the Ticket podcast that I was doing for the ABC, I wasn't allowed to take the name The Ticket with me, but essentially it's a similar podcast. I'm looking at the issues in sport, you know, the sort of global machinations, looking at governance, looking at getting things right, and all with an aim to always making sport just that little bit better, because it is something we all love. Mm-hmm. And it's it just provides sort of in-depth, longer-form conversations, very similar to the ones you have on your podcast.
Oh, Tracy, you're very kind and always kind with your time. You know, you've got a bunch of big
Robin, it
on
costs
this
less than the cost of a toasted sandwich a month. So if you're like me, you need to lose a couple of pounds, just forgo the cost of the toasted sandwich and you subscribe to the Sports Ambassador.
Yeah. I think it's about $2.50 US a week.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, no, get on board, Tracy. We'll support you and broadcast it as much as we possibly can to our audience who are all football and broader sporting fans. So we like to dig a little deeper into to what goes on rather than just look at the scores on the scoreboard. Hey, Tracy, stay well. We better let you go. The story will play out. I'm sure we'll talk to you again about it as it does, and we'll keep listening to the Sports Ambassador and wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you both. See you.
Right. Tracy bye-bye. Holmes, one of the leading voices in sport in this country for many, many years. Okay, stick around. We've been talking a lot about what's been going on off the field with Sam Kerr. Next up, Derek and Willem are going to take over and talk to one of the Guardian's best, most thoughtful and knowledgeable journalists on what is shaping up as an incredible Premier League title race. Of course, I speak of none other than Jonathan Wilson. That's next on Box to Box. Yes, it's Chemist Warehouse time. Now, for our national, international listeners, Chemist Warehouse are right behind the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, Run for the Kids. We're doing an outside broadcast down there for the House of Wellness radio show with my good friend Gerald Quigley, the pharmacist extraordinaire, Luke Hines, the host, and Sarah Davidson, who is the wonderful broadcaster from the Seize the A podcast, Mario Tasconi. He is like a legend of running. He's gone from a bloke who was chuffing on his Marlboros and eating whatever he liked to running marathons in 3 hours and 16 minutes at all at the age of 56. I just can't believe it. So he's inspired 300 runners from Chemist Warehouse to get involved, and I'm going to be one of them. I'm only going to run the 5K short course over the Balti Bridge because I am helping out with the outside broadcast as well. But if you are anywhere near the area in Melbourne, then get along and cheer on the team. So this is just a shout out to Mario, and to wrap it up briefly to Nikki and Matt Verrocchi, who with their beautiful son Rafi, who's been going through a leukemia battle in recent times, his little fella, the whole family is right behind him, their little daughter Flossie as well. So our friends at Chemist Warehouse, a massive shout out to you ahead of the run for the kids. Support them if you can. Jump onto the Royal Children's Hospital website and make a donation. It's all for the kids.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
It's taken a while for some to want to believe it, but the Premier League is officially a race in three after a weekend that saw Arsenal leapfrog Manchester City and Liverpool back into the lead. As we prepare for the final quarter of the campaign, it's a pleasure to welcome back one of the best analytical minds in the game of The Guardian, Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Sunday afternoon, the showpiece clash of Manchester City and Liverpool. A win would have seen either back to the top of the table, but it wasn't to be as a one-all draw played out. I'll ask you about Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp in just a moment. But to start, the game itself, did you feel a draw was a fair result? And what were your key takeaways?
I think City had much better of the first half. I think you saw the control they try and impose on games. They largely had that in the first half. Obviously, you know, going 1-0 up. But then from the moment that Liverpool get the penalty or 2 minutes into the second half, I know Doku hit the post late on, but really Liverpool were, you know, with the side having the chances, you suspect that they may regret not having taken one of them and putting a bit of clear water between them and City. I still feel City are the more reliable side. I mean, I don't think City are playing particularly well at this stage, which feels an odd thing to say when they've won, what is it, 15 out of 17 now, and the other two are draws. So, yeah, City obviously have that game coming up against Arsenal, which is huge. But I don't know. It feels like the fixtures have fallen fairly kindly for City, that they had a pretty straightforward run for, I mean, going on for 3 months before yesterday. And that was a period when they weren't at their best, and they were still getting results because of the level of team they were playing. And now some games that looked like they could be tricky, that Villa game, the Brighton game they've got coming up, I think probably aren't quite as hard as they might have been had they played them 2 or 3 months ago. So I still have City as favourites. And I think Liverpool will feel that when they have the home game second, that was an opportunity to put points between them and City, give themselves a bit of breathing space. And I think that's probably why so much attention has gone on that late penalty decision for the instant where Doku kicks the ball but then carries on into McAllister's chest. And yeah, for me, it's 50-50. I could go either way. I think VAR was right not to intervene. I don't think that's a clear and obvious error. And it's just in the moment. Michael Oliver has to decide, yeah, is the force excessive? Yeah, but what was, you know, when these issues where a defender takes the ball and follows through into the forward, I think are never clear cut. And I think my instinct is just about he got it right, but had he given it the other way, I don't think I'd have been necessarily saying that was a disgrace either.
The respectful rivalry, I think it's fair to call it, between Klopp and Guardiola has been the defining matchup of the Premier League since they arrived within sort of 12 months of each other at their respective clubs. Despite having won more league titles, Klopp is the only manager to whom Guardiola concedes a losing record in England. And unless they meet in the FA Cup, it's going to be 12 wins to 11. It does seem a little bit reductionist, though, to discuss numbers. Do you think this is a rivalry that needs to be decided, or one that we should just sort of enjoy as having been a pretty even affair and, yeah, a defining one over the past 6 or 7 years?
I mean, it's been a fantastic rivalry, and yeah, as to who's slightly on top, you know, who cares, frankly? The point is that Klopp has challenged Guardiola on a consistent basis, which nobody else has. I mean, you say he's the only manager with a winning record. Nathan Jones also has a winning record against Guardiola, but that's a very freakish stat and happened in one game. So, yeah, of managers who played a substantial number of games, Klopp's the only one who's even close to a 50-50 record. And that, I think, shows how consistently good his Liverpool have been. And given how City have dominated anyway, you sort of think how boring the Premier League could have been over the last 6 or 7 years if Liverpool hadn't been there to mount a challenge. So I think we have... Yeah, people will look at Klopp's record in years to come and think, you know, why is he so revered when he's only won one, maybe two league titles and one Champions League? But the point is that with less resources, I mean, almost half a spend of, just over half a spend of City, he's kept Liverpool, you know, within touching distance and at least maintained the semblance of a challenge in most seasons. So I think we've got to be grateful for that. And I think it's good that they play football in quite different ways and they clearly learn from each other. And it's nice, actually, in modern football to see a rivalry where it's not toxic, where they're not constantly taking pops at each other in press conferences. They clear, you know, obviously during games occasionally there's little flashpoints, but fundamentally over the last 8 years they've got on pretty well and they clearly do have a healthy mutual respect.
Jonathan, you mentioned sort of City's form, and their form against the so-called Big Six teams has been pretty poor by their standards this season, just that one win over Manchester United recently. Do you discern an issue there with the bigger teams? Are teams beginning to work them out, or has the fear factor slightly dipped? And do you think that could have any bearing when City will go on their next outing in the Premier League against Arsenal?
I think the fact that Arsenal have beaten them, well, you know, once in the Community Shield on penalties and then, you know, beaten them in the league, I think Arsenal, who for a long time went into these games, particularly away to Big Six teams, you're with a real sense of insecurity, I think that won't be there. I think Arsenal can take them on. Arsenal's game against Brentford on Saturday, that's a little bit worrying, I think, the way they lost control in the second half when they've been completely dominate the first half, should be 2 or 3 nil up, give away a stupid goal. And then it was sort of the panicky Arsenal we've got a bit used to in previous seasons. But yeah, fair play to them. They got the win in the end. And I guess that's ultimately the more important thing. And they can reset now before that City game. But I think what's happened with City is that the signing of Haaland, it's one of those paradoxical signings where Guardiola had been... The two things where you define Guardiola's side. So one was they didn't play with an orthodox centre-forward. They played with somebody who tended to drop off, to become an auxiliary midfielder, to create more angles, to help them dominate possession. And there was very rarely a focus on one goal scorer. And that led to friction with Sergio Aguero, for instance, who obviously a great, great goal scorer and a great, great City player, but he never seemed quite to fit the Guardiola vision. So to bring Haaland in, who's even more sort of orthodox in being a number nine than Aguero, always seems slightly odd. Now, broke all kinds of goal scoring records last season. He's still the leading Premier League goal scorer this season with 18. But his presence means that City don't control games in midfield in the way that they used to. You know, Guardiola, when he was at Barcelona, said that when his team won the ball back, unless it was a really obvious pass on to release a counter-attack, he liked his team to play 15 passes to get set to deal with the possibility of losing the ball. Now, because they play with a high line, the way the Guardiola teams were always slightly vulnerable was balls in, played in behind them, though those quick counters. And you've seen, even in the Premier League, the years when City haven't won the league, they've been getting caught out a lot by that type of chance. And this season, they've conceded more goals to fast breaks than any Premier League team apart from Crystal Palace. So that is a problem for them. And I think Haaland actually makes that more pronounced, because they're playing the ball forward quicker to him to try and release him, because he's so good at playing on the shoulder of the last defender. I think the injury to John Stones maybe has played a part in that he's so good at becoming that auxiliary midfielder. I think not having Gundogan has been an issue. I think Ruben Diaz's slight loss of form this season has been an issue. Cancelo leaving in the middle of last season, I think he was very good at becoming that second holding midfielder alongside Rodri. These are tiny issues given how good City are, given their record. But I think naturally Haaland's lack of involvement in a game is more problematic again, the better the team you play against, because that's when you need the control. Against lesser sides, having somebody who will bang in hundreds of goals is great. But against the better teams, they can just sort of shut off a supply to him, as Liverpool did yesterday. I mean, Haaland was barely a factor yesterday. So I think that's something Arsenal will be conscious of. The fact they did it so well at the Emirates, I think they will think they can do that again. And that is an issue for Guardiola going into the next season, is how does he bring back that control without losing the cutting edge that Haaland's given them?
Well, the game of the Emirates you mentioned before, the celebration police were out in force again. Arteta fist pumping like mad to every corner of the stadium. Regardless of where anyone sits on this particular debate, is there something a bit deeper here, which is Arsenal almost treating every game like a cup final, a little bit all or nothing? And are they just setting themselves up for a little bit of a big fall when the fall comes? Could they be a little bit more homeostatic in their approach?
I couldn't care less how much teams celebrate. I do think last season, I think all of us, our perception of where we were in the season was totally skewed by the World Cup. And it sort of felt like we got back from a World Cup and we were already in the title running. And actually, there's still more than half a season to play. And those games where Arsenal nicked the win at Aston Villa, nicked the win at home to Bournemouth, when they've been a bit shambolic, but just sort of dragged themselves over the line. The tendency at the time was to talk about, these are the kind of games that champions win. They find a way. And you heard quite a lot of that on Saturday as well. Like, champions find a way. Well, yeah, that's true, but you only want a couple of them in a season. That can't be the way you play. You can't rely on dramatic late goals. Arsenal have been, since they came back from Dubai, since the winter break, they have been brilliant. It was 31-4-3 against in seven games, I think, before Saturday. You can't deny they've been playing brilliant football. And they played brilliant football in the first half. And then as soon as something went against them, the Ramsdale error, which leads to the Wissa goal, the clearance just bounces off him, which is a freakish occurrence. they did sort of go back into panic mode, and you could feel the tension and them moaning at refereeing decisions. And every time a Brentford player went down, there's sort of boos, and Arsenal players are getting in the referee's face. And you just sort of think, like, you're better than them. Just calm down and play and you will win. And you can equally flip that on his head and say they had loads of chances and Brentford players were chucking themselves in the way of the ball. And one of those could have gone in early. It could have been much easier. Declan Rice at the angle of post and bar. And they did get the win ultimately. But I think your fear is it a little bit like the Bournemouth game last season? Where, yes, yeah, celebrate the win. It's great they've got the 3 points. They took them top of the table. They're still top of the table. All of that's clearly a good thing. But the sort of loss of composure in the second half would trouble me.
Staying in North London, I suppose, rounding out the race, at least for the top four in the Champions League, Spurs had a statement win over Aston Villa on Sunday. They're one of the most exciting teams in the league. There's no doubt about that. How do you rate Ange's first season with Spurs? And, you know, do you almost think people have forgotten about just what a shit show that he took over, the damage that had been done by the last managers? This undoubtedly is his biggest task in football as well. Maybe the Australian listeners of our show will rate the Socceroos higher. But, you know, can we underestimate just how well he has done this season?
Yeah, I think it's one of those debates that's been going on so long that it's sort of descended as debates do in football into these sort of meta debates. So, yeah, he inherited a shit show, as you put it. It was an absolute mess. And that first sort of month of the season was incredible to see the difference he made. And, yeah, there was a point when I think Spurs were 5 points clear at one point, and nobody thought they were going to win the league. Nobody thought they were in the title challenge. And you know, the start of the season, if you said they're going to be top four, even top five, you just said that is a very, very substantial achievement, particularly given the football they're playing, the fact they are so exciting, the fact that you just like watching them. There's a real sense of progress. You can see where the team's going. You can see where it needs improving. The fact they've done that with a load of injuries, with players being away at the Cup of Nations, it's all incredibly impressive. But there is a slight issue that, A, I think you're right. I think some people have forgotten the Messi inherited, and they are starting thinking, well, hang on, they were top in August, and now they're only fifth. Maybe they've gone backwards a bit. And then you also have the next stage of that, which is, I was at the game when they beat Palace 2 weeks ago, week on Saturday, where, to be honest, it's an odd game. They had 80% possession. They had loads of chances. But they were behind till the 77th minute. And you did think, they're not great here. They're a little bit lacking in imagination. And it had looked like they run out of ideas. And then Brendan Johnson coming off the bench changes the game. Timo Werner finally scores. Yeah, really good movement from him. And he's such an odd player because he's so good at everything apart from actually scoring goals, although he has now got 2-2. And then they score the 3 in 11 minutes or whatever it was. And it looks in the end like quite a comfortable victory, but it wasn't. And one of the things they are good at is scoring goals in clutches, as he did against Villa. But in my match report, I sort of said they weren't all that the first sort of 75 minutes or so. They weren't playing with quite the same pizzazz that they had early in the season. I got loads of Spurs fans like, "Oh, have you forgotten what you inherited?" No, I haven't. I'm just saying they're not as good now as they were at the start of the season. That was always going to be the case. They're still clearly better than they were last season. If they finish fourth, that's an incredible achievement. If they finish fifth, that'll probably be enough for Champions League, and that's also a great achievement. It looks now that they're not going to finish lower than that because United are so bad. This has been a really, really good season for Tottenham, and I think next season could be even better, and that's really exciting, and it's a great testament to the work that Ange has done.
Jonathan, we could ask you about just about every club, but we'll let you go. A quarter of the season to run and still no clearer as to where we do go from here, but that is what we like. So thank you for helping us consider these things on a deeper level, and my apologies to Nathan Jones as well as we close.
Paul Cook as well, if you want another one for Wigan, but yes.
Okay, done. Always more to learn, always more to do. Jonathan Wilson of The Guardian, thank you very much.
Cheers, thank you.
Stick around on the other side, a bit of World Cup corner to close.
Willa, willa, willa. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
I love eating good food. It's a constant challenge to come up with flavours in a family that everyone's going to want to eat. But I nailed one in the past week, and I created it off the back of an Italian classic pasta dish, Willem, called pasta aglio olio. Now, do you know what those two ingredients are?
They're my two favourite words in Italian, Rob: garlic and oil.
Haha, you do, of course. So anyone who likes their Italian food will know that that's one of the most simple dishes that you can make. Garlic, oil, generally a little dried chilli, some linguine or thin pasta, and some parmesan cheese, or pecorino if you like something a little bit with a bit more bite. But I got my Italian sausages out and made some meatballs with it. And you know what the key to the dish was? It pulled it all together with a real kick, Willem.
Something from Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Exactly, Derek. I bet you know that the Hoyt's chili flakes, they're just that ingredient that just finishes off a dish, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, you can pretty much put them in anything. I put them in an omelette I was making the other day, and I just felt like just having something a bit extra in there just to bring it to life, and I just sprinkled in a few of those Hoyt's chili flakes, and it was a treat.
Absolutely. So if you're looking for something simple, you don't have to get over complex. Just get along to your local Coles, Woolworths, or good independent supermarkets. Empty spice jars in your house. We'll fill them with Hoyt's value packs. You'll be happy with Hoyt's.
Fill those empties with Hoyt's spices, yeah. Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. We hope you've enjoyed the show this week. We do put a lot of time and effort into putting together every show every week, and we try to pick the eyes out of the best stories. And I'm not sure that there are any bigger stories around the football world from a domestic and an international point of view than our chat with Tracy Holmes on the Sam Kerr story and Jonathan Wilson, insofar as the preeminent football journalists around the globe. Jonathan is certainly in that company, and it was a great chat with Derek and Willem just now. But it's World Cup corner time, Willem. We are staring down the barrel of a lot of Olympic, a lot of World Cup qualifying. Where are you going to meander that path for us for today?
Yeah, Ed's just going to speak broadly about which sides have qualified for the Olympics and who are still in the running. But from the Australian perspective, in the men's or the boys with the Oli Roos, Tony Vidmar's this week named 26 players for a trip to Saudi Arabia. They're going to play the West Asian Football Federation Championship, which is the last preparatory camp before next month's Olympic qualifier. So it's all coming in a bit of a rush for the Oli Roos. They're going to play three matches, which are going to be decided on the fly by the looks of things. There's eight teams there, including Iraq, Thailand, Egypt, and the squad. No Alessandro Cercatti, Edge, or Alexander Robertson, which is due to the fact that this falls outside the international window. Now, neither of those gents were picked for the Asian Cup either, and the loose reason for that was sort of given that it was because they were going to be playing for the Oli Roos at the Olympics should they qualify, and that it was probably not going to be feasible to ask the clubs to release them both times. So that's a watch. There's a bit of frustration that neither of those guys are here. Those that are here, a pair of brothers, Alu and Goran Kuol and Corey and Jake Holman, Tom Waddingham, who's been scoring a few goals for Brisbane Roar, Ryan Teague, Alex Popovich, plenty of A-League names who already have a bit of senior football behind them. So that is Tony Vidmar's remit at the minute, to get those boys to the Olympics. Who else is there, Edge?
Well, it's interesting. In the men's competition, obviously the host nation, France, automatically qualifies. CONCACAF's representatives will be the United States and the Dominican Republic. So Mexico is the obvious one that's missed out at that stage. Dominican Republic, not known for their football heritage in Olympic Games. Derek, are you surprised that they got there?
Yeah, they're not renowned at the top level of football. So yeah, I've got to admit that they wouldn't have been on my list of qualifiers for the tournament, Edge.
And in Europe, the qualifiers are Spain, Israel, and Ukraine. So no England, no Germany. Again, questions over the significance. I think this is why clubs are not too endeared with releasing players with them for Olympic qualifiers, because I just don't think the professional football holds this Olympic competition for men in too much regard. Having said that, in Africa, Morocco, Egypt and Mali have qualified. Oceania's representative is New Zealand, and the South Americans, their representatives are Paraguay and Argentina. That leaves the Asian Football Confederation, which has the top three places in the under-23 AFC Asian Cup, which is obviously in April and May. Australia's group, believe it or not, Vietnam, Korea and Iraq. It'll be tough to get out of the group. We need to win the group to give ourselves a chance to qualify. It's going to be a hard road, I think. And also, for the first time, there's a playoff. The fourth-placed Asian team will play off against the fourth-placed African team, Derek, which is Guinea. So that'll be an interesting home and away league for the Oilers if they get involved in that. Over to Guinea. Have you been to Guinea, Derek, in your travels?
No, I've been to East Africa plenty of times, but never out to the West. But Guinea have got some pedigree. I mean, they did pretty well in AFCON, didn't they?
They did, side, yeah, they did. So something good is happening there.
Yeah, there's definitely something in the water in Guinea at the moment.
Yeah, and in the women, let's just go through them. Obviously, now that we know that Australia has qualified, so France, the host nation, qualifies. Obviously, only 12 teams at the Olympic Games for women, so there's only one representative of CONCACAF. That's the United States. South America has two representatives, Brazil and Colombia. Canada and New Zealand have also qualified. Canada through a playoff. Spain and Germany will be Europe's other two representatives, obviously, to join France. And Australia and Japan will be Asia's representatives. And we're down to the last hurdle for the women in Africa. One of Zambia or Morocco will qualify. They're in a head-to-head playoff. And also one of Nigeria and South Africa will also qualify. So in the women, it's France, United States, Brazil, Colombia, Canada, New Zealand, Spain, Germany, Australia, Japan, and two African nations to come.
Comprehensive there, Reg. Rob, before we close, I just want a word for the Central Coast Mariners in Asia. This probably deserves to be a little bit earlier in the show, but we'll get it in nonetheless. They've got one foot in the interzone playoff finals of the AFC Cup. They've beaten Odisha of India 4-0 in the first of two legs in Gosford. The second leg is this Thursday. Progression there is likely to set up an interzone playoff final with FK Abdish Attak Kant, who are the league leaders in Kyrgyzstan at present. And that is the final stage before the final. Good luck to the Mariners.
Hey, guys, can I jump in just with a very tenuous World Cup corner link? I did send Adam a clip that I thought we should play in the headlines, but we didn't mention Spurs. And, of course, Ange, being the former Socceroos coach, gives us an inkling for World Cup corner. But I just laughed out loud when I heard this clip of him responding to a reporter question after the game.
Still a long way to go, Ange, but what does this do for your push for the top four?
It means we're one game closer, mate, so still 11 games to go. I think, I guess everyone else is billing this as a sort of do or die for us. I assume now we're not dead yet.
So good. He's the only guy I know that can make the word mate sound sinister in an interview. And he clearly just does not buy into any of the Sky Sports hype wagon bullshit narrative stuff. He just, he doesn't get involved in it, does he? You guys know about this? This is all very new to me, and I thought that was very funny.
No, he's got about 40 different inflections on the word mate, and he can weaponize them in any way he wants, Rob.
Yeah, you described it beautifully. It was a lovely little clip, and Ed, you'll remember one occasion where I was on the receiving end of a friendly mate, wasn't I, during the Asian Cup. I think you were watching a press conference and you recognised my voice asking him a question on one occasion, and I got the nice mate at the very least. But now, before we go, very quickly, guys, just a shout-out to Martin Boyle, probably the unluckiest socceroo of recent times the Scottish Cup quarterfinal defeat against Rangers for Hibs. He landed heavily on his head in a set two with John Sutar. Didn't look like anything, well, to use your word, Willem Sinister, from Sutar, Harry's brother, of course, but he's recovering well after a head knock in that game. Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump on the bench and leave stoppage time to you, Michael. Thanks again, mate.
Yeah, great show. Great to have Tracy Holmes unpacking all of that Samantha Kerr controversy. And the Premier League title race, Arsenal still in the hunt, Rob. Excellent. Still in the hunt.
Well, you guys can continue to talk about it in stoppage time or without me, but I'm looking forward to these final 10 weeks. So we will see who gets their nose over the finish line at the very end. Derek, thank you.
Thanks, gents.
Willem?
Yeah, looking forward to stoppage time midweek, Rob. Thank you.
And our good mate Adam Maloney behind the glass, the metaphorical glass, so to speak, editing and clipping the whole show together and publishing it, making sure it's all done as professionally as any podcast as it is there out there. Well done to you, Adam. to you, our listeners. We couldn't do it without you. Please subscribe to Box to Box, Stoppage Time and Offside, wherever you get your podcast. Tweet us at Box to Box NTS and follow us on X. Make sure you like us on Facebook if you haven't already, and join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.